make the introduction of the moderator, Judge Chad Riedler of the Sixth Circuit, because due to some last-minute changes and shifts, our chairman of the Labor and Employment Practice Group, which is hosting this get-together, has received a battlefield promotion to a speaker, so he will have to deal with that. I'm very glad that my lot has fallen to the much less burdensome job of introducing our moderator. Judge Chad Riedler is a double Michigan graduate with a law degree and undergraduate degree and has had a stellar career in the middle part of the country. He clerked for Judge Alan Norris on the Sixth Circuit and went to work at Jones Day, where he worked in international and, in issues and appeals. And from there found his way to the civil division of the U.S. Department of Justice, and eventually in March of 2019 found himself appointed and confirmed to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. And along the way, interestingly enough, he has served in with Lawyers Without Borders in such far-flung places as Kenya and Moldova, so he should be perfectly at home in Washington, D.C. today. So without further ado, I will present you to Judge Riedler.
Thank you, Betsy. So good morning. It's great to be here with all of you. I hope you've enjoyed the conference almost as much as I have. My voice is suffering a bit, maybe from too much exuberance here at the conference, but it's been a great week, and it was hard to leave the Mayflower, but I think we found a really wonderful home here at the Hilton, and had some terrific programming, a great dinner, and we have a wonderful panel this morning to help sort of close out the week and the weekend. So our topic is agency exuberance, and we're going to discuss specifically the EEOC and NLRB. We're going to talk about some of the things that have happened over the last few years, and given recent events, we're going to look forward to see what may be happening in the coming years. And we have some really terrific experts to talk about those topics. So my job is to introduce them and to set up the conversation, and I think it'll be pretty free-flowing from there. And as always, we'll look forward to your questions at the end of our time together. So I'll introduce the speakers in the order they're going to speak. Let me first start with Bradford Kelly. Brad is a shareholder in Littler Mendelson's Washington, D.C. office, and he specializes in advising clients about emerging technologies, including artificial intelligence. Before joining Littler, Brad was chief counsel to a commissioner at the EEOC. Previously, he served as a senior official in the Department of Labor's Wage and Hour Division. His work on AI has been published in numerous law journals, including at Stanford and Yale. And before becoming an attorney, Brad was a U.S. Army infantry and intelligence officer, and he's a veteran of the Iraq War. Thank you for your service. Rebecca Dorman is a labor consultant with over 25 years of experience managing and supervising employees, including successfully negotiating agreements between employers and unions. Becky joined People Results earlier this year, where she helps organizations improve employee engagement and performance. Prior to joining People Results, Becky was the assistant to the regional director at the NLRB for Region 15 in New Orleans. She's a frequent presenter at legal conferences in Louisiana and around the country, including at the ABA's annual meeting. R. Pepper Crutcher, Jr. is a partner at Balk and Bingham LLP and general counsel to the Mississippi Manufacturers Association. Pepper advises and advocates for a wide range of Southeast United States private sector employers. He regularly defends employment litigation, including class and collective actions, and both defends and prosecutes unfair competition claims. Pepper's labor law practice involves all types of NLRB proceedings, labor contract negotiations, and arbitration. And let me say, given the gathering today, that he's also the chair of the practice group that's putting on today's program. So with that, Brad, you want to start us off?
Yeah, thank you very much. Really appreciate being here. And so as the judge mentioned, my name is Brad Kelly, and I'm a shareholder at Littler Mendelson's DC office. Littler is the world's largest labor and employment law firm representing management. And I do a host of labor and employment issues, but I specialize in artificial intelligence. I'm also a core member of Littler's Workplace Policy Institute, which is essentially our government relations and advocacy arm. So I've testified before Congress on AI, and I've worked with the Senate Help Committee on veterans affairs issues and veterans employment protections. Before joining Littler, I was at the EEOC, where I was highly involved with the EEOC's artificial intelligence initiative. and which was launched in October of 2021 to address the issues of artificial intelligence that might be used for discriminatory purposes. Before the EOC, I was at the Wage and Hour Division, and I have the unique honor of serving as a political appointee in both the Trump administration and the Biden administration. So I was able to see the transition and what happened. And, you know, when I was in the Army, we had a saying, this is what right looks like, and that's what you're trying to replicate. And then I think that from my perspective, from the Trump and Biden administrations, Trump, I know what right looks like with the Trump administration. I also know what wrong looks like when it comes to the Biden administration. So I think that's some good insight. Before going to law school, I was an Army infantry and intelligence officer and an Iraq War vet. And it was actually that experience that led me to become a labor and employment lawyer and to specialize in military leave issues as well. Some of my soldiers, when we were deployed to Iraq, had military leave issues. They were serving in the Guard and Reserves, so I helped them out, and that's what motivated me to go to law school and go the labor and employment route. For my remarks today, I'm going to do a high-level discussion over the impact of the election and what to expect from a labor and employment angle. And then I'm going to talk briefly about the EOC, and then I'm going to move to a discussion of artificial intelligence and how labor and employment agencies have addressed artificial intelligence and how that's a way of looking at the exuberance of these agencies in agency action. So for the impact of the election, I think that for labor and employment purposes, it's kind of general, you know, across the board from what I'm sure you've heard for throughout the week is that, you know, for labor and employment, you're going to see a lot of changes in the regulations and executive orders. Labor and employment law is well known for its flip-flopping or the pendulum swing. So during Democratic administrations, it favors employees and unions. And then during Republican administration, it favors employers and the management side. So I think that historically, there's always been different waves. But as we're going to discuss today with the impact of Loper-Bright, how will that impact that swinging? Also, for enforcement priorities, it's going to change a lot. You know, Democratic administrations have often focused on gotcha enforcement, where, you know, they won't put out clear standards, they won't put out clear guidance, whereas Republican administrations have tried to put out as much employer assistance as possible. When we were at the Wage and Hour Division, we put out a lot of opinion letters where you could submit a request based off of the scenario of how the law applies, you know, for a real world situation, and then get a response from the government about how that issue is. And it was so successful that OFCCP copied the model, and the EOC put out 5 opinion letters as well. And it was just a very successful way of putting out guidance. So I think one of the biggest changes for administrative purposes is that you're going to see the incoming Trump administration put out a lot more guidance and help for employers. Obviously, staffing matters for federal agencies. You know, I think it's going to be especially interesting to see the impact of, you know, Elon and Vivek on, you know, the Department of Government Efficiency and how that's going to affect, you know, how this. Or as somebody who was an alum of both the EOC and the Department of Labor, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of waste there, and it'll be very interesting to see what we're able to do with making the government more efficient. Now, I'm going to move now to talk about the EOC, the agency that I came from. So the EOC is the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and it's the federal agency that enforces the laws against job discrimination and harassment. So some of the most common laws that you hear about, Title VII is covered, Americans with Disabilities Act, the Age Discrimination Employment Act, the Genetic Information Act as well. And EEOC commissioners are appointed by the president, and that's subject to Senate confirmation. And there's 5 seats on the EEOC, so you have a 3-2 split. But right now, the composition of the EEOC is 3 Democrats, 1 Republican, and you have 1 vacancy. So even though you have 3 Democrats in the majority at the EEOC now, the president is able to appoint the chair of the EEOC. And the chair has a lot of administrative power. So that's something that cannot be underestimated. And even for what I'm going to discuss later about AI guidance is that all the AI guidance out of the EOC was unilaterally issued by the chair. It was issued solely by the chair. So it just is one example of, you know, the power that the chair of the EOC has. Historically, the general counsel has not been fired, but Biden, changed that. When Biden came into office, he fired the EOC general counsel, but it wasn't immediate. You know, as we'll hear with Becky, when President Biden was inaugurated, he fired the NLRB's general counsel within 30 minutes or so. For the EOC, Biden waited a couple months before firing the general counsel, and we fully anticipate that the general counsel now, who's a Biden appointee, will be also fired. So we expect that President Trump will appoint who he wants for the general counsel's role at the EOC, and the general counsel is in charge of litigation and different initiatives such as that. Some of the big focuses that, you know, the EOC is going to be looking at is, obviously, there's a big focus on diversity, equity, inclusion, DEI initiatives, and how employers are using DEI practices. That's something we're expecting a lot of. We're also expecting a big focus on different religious liberty issues in the workplace and how that is going to go about. So I'm going to turn now to talk about artificial intelligence. We'll get more into the EOC during questions, but the reason I think that, for the title of this session is agency exuberance, and I had forgotten what that term meant, so I had to look it up. According to the dictionary, it means the quality of being full of energy and excitement. So it's basically the opposite of Jeb Bush. But when I think of exuberance, though, I think about the government regulating AI. You know, AI is such an interesting concept. You hear about AI on the news. You hear about it in TV programs. During the Super Bowl in February, there was two major commercials dealing with artificial intelligence, and those became two of the most popular apps that were downloaded the next day. So obviously, if people are interested, the government's going to be interested. So, you had these government agencies step up in terms of, to say, well, we want to regulate AI in certain ways. But what have they done to regulate artificial intelligence in a meaningful way? And so as a labor and employment lawyer, the main type of artificial intelligence that we're seeing is that employers are using AI throughout the employment life cycle. So that means from hiring to firing to everything between. So it's being used to monitor employee productivity and to streamline operations. You know, we all hear of generative AI programs that can help employees be more productive in the workplace. And a lot of employers are using it to screen resumes, to say, here's a batch of a million applications, who are the most qualified? It can screen out who do not meet certain qualifications. So if they don't meet the educational requirements or the experience levels, then those can be sorted out. It's also using, a lot of companies are using AI-powered chatbots to answer questions. So if you're looking for a job and you get onto a employer's website, you'll have an AI chatbot that can answer questions about, you can ask it, what's your remote work policy? Can I work from home? And the chatbot will generate an answer. We've also seen AI being used to help those with disabilities. You know, as an Iraq War veteran, I've seen a lot of artificial intelligence tools that have helped combat wounded warriors be fully integrated back into the workplace. It's incredible technology. But even with these incredible benefits of AI, there's been a big focus on artificial intelligence that's been used in a bad way, the misuse of artificial intelligence tools. There's clear risk involved. So in the example of resume sorting, what if it's sorting out the resumes of those in a protected class? And you've got disparate impact issues that mainly arise there. But there's also been concerns about artificial intelligence for anti-union purposes. You know, the NLRB put out a memo that I'll talk about more in detail later, where they created a presumption against the use of these tools. And the main focus for that was the idea that what if AI can be used for anti-union purposes? So if somebody had been affiliated with a union, so if they had served as an intern in a union in the past, we want to sort out their resume. Or if there's AI-powered GPS systems where you could see an employer is able to track if there's possible union activity going on. Are they gathering for purposes of union organizing? So because of these risks, you've seen a big focus from the government on artificial intelligence. And one of the other types of risks that was involved was if AI tools are being used to determine what an employee should be paid, making sure that that complies with the wage and hour laws, particularly the Fair Labor Standards Act. So with these clear risks, the government became very exuberant about getting involved with this. But the problem is it's largely failed, and I'll kind of highlight some of the reasons that the government's done such a bad job. And I think that it really illustrates how bad some of the laws are and how the government hasn't fully responded. So one of the first examples is that the Federal Labor and Employment Agencies that have issued guidance have really failed to provide meaningful or updated guidance with any form of consistency. So it's been a year and a half since the EEOC has issued any guidance. And they haven't put out any guidance on generative AI technologies, even though those are the most widely used AI tools out there. And the EEOC launched its initiative in October of 2021 and has only put out a handful of guidance documents. And again, it's been a year and a half since they've issued any guidance. And it's really unfortunate because a lot of times when we hear from the employer community, they want to hear, well, how do we comply with these, with the laws? You know, how do we comply with Title VII? How do we comply with the ADA? And, you know, where is this guidance that helps, you know, drive this? And a second reason I think that's very important is that the AI guidance that's been issued by the Labor and Employment Agencies has not gone through the proper processes for the promulgation of guidance or policies. So, for example, the EEOC's guidance has been unilaterally issued by the chair. It hasn't been voted on by the commission, and it's been, you know, it's been really unfortunate. A third reason is that the AI guidance issued by Labor and Employment Agencies has not been benefited from the notice and comment procedures of the APA. And I think this is really important because AI is rapidly developing. And you hear of, you know, before October of 2022, nobody had heard of ChatGPT, and now it's a household name. And with these rapid developments, why aren't you opening it up to hear from the vendors, to hear from those who are actually creating these software and creating this technology? Fourth reason, Labor and Employment Agencies have not engaged key stakeholders. And this is really important because the EEOC has only held one public hearing since launching the AI initiative in October of 2021. And again, not hearing from those who create these create this technology and those who are selling this technology. It really would really gratefully benefit from notice and comment and from hearing diverse perspectives. Fifth, the Labor and Employment Agency's guidance documents have been very biased against employers. And this has been, you've seen this with a lot of the guidance documents that have come out. And I think it's a very unfortunate development. And it's something that it's very big focus, I think, going forward. But.
Great. Thank you, Brad. Becky, is this on? Oh, great, thank you, Brad. Becky, I think you're now gonna give us some insights into the NLRB.
I am making sure mine's on too. Thank you, Judge. And I was going to say, I'm kind of building on my on the comments by my colleague Brad, and making sure that in the NLRB, keeping with the panel's title, probably has gone a little far for agency exuberance. It's probably become a flaw. But I spent 24 years and 11 months at the NLRB. I started off as a field agent. I moved up to a first line supervisor, and then moved up to an assistant regional director where I served for 7 years prior to my resignation over the summer due to philosophical differences with the NLRB over their exuberance. The NLRB, like the EEOC, is a 3-2 split with right now we have three Democratic board members, one Republican with one vacant Republican seat. Although there have been a couple decisions issued in the last couple of weeks that makes me wonder what really will happen. The Democratic chairman's term is up December 16th of this year, but there is a pending renomination for her as a package deal to fill the other Republican seat with a nominee from Seyfarth Shaw, Josh Deidelberg. It's a lame duck Congress. It's interesting whether it'll go, whether there's really enough votes or not. As y'all know, it's 49. It's technically a 49-49 split with two independents who generally vote Democratic. So we will. So it would be questionable whether there's really enough votes to get it through. And in, like I said, in light of a couple of decisions that aren't on our agenda that were issued in the past couple of weeks, it may not. The general counsel, as Brad alluded to, was our general counsel, Jennifer Abruzzo, was put in place for our general counsel, Peter Robb, who was fired within 30 minutes of Biden being sworn in. That did go through the court system and ultimately was found the firing, it was legitimate and legal. I feel that the favor will be returned there are people, I picture people in the command center who have already written these emails. so that when Biden, so when Trump takes his hand off the Bible, there's somebody to automatically hit send. I don't know if they'll even wait 30 minutes. 30 seconds may be a long time. They already have the AI together. We may get you to weigh in on that. So we'll see how that goes. As we all know, our general counsel, Jennifer Brusseau, has had quite the union agenda. She backed Biden's statement that he was going to be the most union-friendly president America has ever seen. And she lived up to it at all cost. And so just to kind of get into a little bit about my story, about how I ended up leaving, and how I feel that agency exuberance became a flaw, I was put on a joint national commission by the NLRB to oversee a large coffee company's representation cases when they were coming in fast and furious. And by the way, the green dress is an absolute accident. It is not a political statement. I was helping out several regions. One of the regions had a mail ballot case. I was helping getting stipulated election agreements amongst the parties. If we couldn't get to an agreement, I would be the hearing officer, and then I would move on to the next petition in whatever region needed help around the country. There was a mail ballot order in one of the regions, and there was an easy question. There was a couple of things that went wrong. The employer submitted a wrong list. It was amended. It was easy to fix. The employer called and asked a very easy question that should have been really easy to answer. They couldn't get any personnel in this region, so they called me because I'd worked on the agreement. And I said, sure, I can look it up in our electronic system and give you the answer. So I looked it up in the electronic case system and looked at the file, and I read the notes. And I couldn't even come up with anything to say, which is really odd. I can generally talk to anything. And all I could say was, can I call you back? Because it was at a crossroads. I saw several notes in there that the region had gone above and beyond and helped the union out in the election and given the union information they should not have and left the employer out of conversations that they should have been included in. So I picked up the phone and called the regional director and said, you've got major problems in this case. You need to rerun this election. I should have prefaced it by one of my expertise is representation cases and elections. That's almost all I did as assistant regional director. That was pretty much all I was in, that was what I was mostly in charge of. It was by the manual. You go by the manual. Even though it's not law, it's our Bible. And this was not being run at all by the manual. And she told me no. She told me she thought it was just fine. So I picked up the phone and called the inspector general and told him my concerns. He told me, I don't get involved in things like that. Policies and procedures, that's not for me. And I said, okay. Well, thank you very much. So I had to think about it for a few minutes. And I have to live with myself and what's right and what's not. And I joined the NLRB to help employees to keep the balance, to uphold a mission, to be neutral. This was far from neutral. And far from my mission, and far from my values. So I picked up the phone and called the employer back and told them the truth and what had happened in detail. From there, they wrote a 16-page letter to the chairman, the general counsel, and to our inspector general. I was anonymous at that point. That was in August of 2022. I was anonymous. I was mentioned in there. They called the attorneys who called me on a Friday night or Saturday morning and said, FYI, you may want to retain an attorney this weekend. We're publishing a letter on Monday, and you're in it. So I did, and I still stand by what I did. It was a long, hard weekend, but I'm still glad I did what I did. And so for about 6 months in there, I was anonymous. My name came out to Congress, and I met with the Senate Health Committee. I met with the Education Workforce Committee, and I got subpoenaed by the Education Workforce Committee in as much as the House had a Republican majority, and I was still an NLRB employee, and I couldn't come out on my own. I needed a subpoena. And I turned over 550 pages of documents from cases all around the country where various regions had helped unions win elections. All the margins were close in the cases that I turned over, or the documents I turned over for the cases I turned over, and it's possible it could have been swayed, and the union may have won many more elections than they should have. The House issued a fairly long report. The Inspector General issued a fairly long report after this letter came out, where I was anonymous. He called me up, he knew who it was, and he said, "Oh, I see what you mean now." Probably a little too late. But he ultimately, at the urging of Congress, did do an investigation and found that the NLRB had engaged in gross malfeasance. Those reports are all public documents. My attorney testified on behalf for me at the Senate Health Committee and told my story about how the agency had gone beyond its scope, gone beyond what they should have, which we have seen in some Supreme Court cases, just to kind of bring it full circle back to the cases mentioned here, like in McKinney versus Supreme Court, which actually came out of my region too. It seems like my region was rather a hotbed for fun. We'll see what the future will hold. I'm still proud of what I did. I still feel that it's the right thing. I left the agency because I waited for reform. I waited for changes. I waited for any guidance to come out. They act as if it never happened, sweep it under the rug, continue with their extremely pro-union agenda. I do know the board swings regularly with the change of the administrations, but this was beyond the pale, and I couldn't live with it. We definitely had a philosophical differences. I left and went management side, and I'm glad I did. I hope the Trump administration, I hope Elon Musk, I hope everybody helps them get back on a path to where we're just used to our normal political swings and they become more honest.
Okay, well, Becky, thank you for those remarks and that very personal story. And Pepper, I understand now you're gonna offer some broad comments on some of these topics and others.
My role is to be more provocative than anybody in government can be, or anybody who might want to again be in government can be. And by the way, anybody in here speak French? Okay, if you speak French, would you turn to the person next to you and explain what ChatGPT means? Because I can't do that on a live stream. It's funny, I promise. Okay, so 30-ish years ago, I took my preteen son to a father-son event at Alpine Camp for Boys in Mentone, Alabama, and there's this long zip line. I mean, like a quarter-mile zip line. It starts from a big rocky promontory and ends up on a forest floor, and there are these 120-foot-tall tulip poplars on both sides of the cleared area. And so the dads and sons started going one after another, and I was near the back of the line. And about in the middle of the line was a guy who had played football at Florida State. And oh, he had his Florida State jersey on, and he watched these guys launching off one at a time, just, you know, lazily going down the zip line. He decided, I'm gonna show y'all how it's done. So he got up, and instead of just going forward, he ran off in this direction so that, being totally unaware of the physics of angular momentum, he started doing this as he went down the zip line, and his speed increased. The oscillation increased until he reached the edge of the cleared area, and we all went, oh, as he squared up a tulip popper. Next day, he had a purple bruise across his chest. Fortunately, no broken ribs. And that is a metaphor to describe what the National Labor Relations Board has been doing in recent administrations. So when we came up for the title of this program, we decided it's going to be so much fun to watch all of our friends who are totally against agency. Originally, we said excess. We changed it to exuberance. Totally against agency excess, decide that now maybe we're going to like agency excess. Okay. My colleague Alex McDonald wrote a great piece in the Federal Society blog about 4 months ago about whether it's even proper to call what the National Labor Relations Board is doing these days law or legal process, or is it just naked politics? Now, I have got people on the other side. I've got friends who are counsel for labor unions. I've got friends who are international reps for unions. They are sincere. They believe they are doing the Lord's work. In private moments, they'll be totally honest with you. And I don't mean to disparage anybody. There are good and bad reasons for doing what they're doing, and I will credit them with the best possible motives. But let me give you just some examples of the kind of thing I'm talking about. Prior to January in 2021, the presidents had respected the four-year term of the sitting NLRB General Counsel. It was taken to be a 10-year protection, and President Biden did away with that. CMEX, any of you, CMEX, ring a bell with any of you? Okay, August 2023. The standard before the CMEX case at the NLRB had been that if you were an employer and you behaved very, very badly during a union election campaign, I'm talking about things like firing union organizers, promising and then granting a pay raise to influence your employees' votes, those are called hallmark violations. If you did those kind of hallmark violation things during a union campaign, the board would be empowered to say, not only do we set aside the election, but we're not going to even let you have another election. If the union can show that it had proof of a majority, typically by signed union cards, before you did these bad things during the organizing campaign, then we're going to just order you to bargain with the union. That's called the Gissel Doctrine, after the Gissel Packing Company case in the Supreme Court many years ago. The CMEX case says, if during the course of a campaign, you do anything we don't like that we think is unfair. And folks, what the board thinks is unfair today can be as simple as having something that they don't like buried deep in your employee handbook that could possibly have influenced a hypothetical reasonable voter against the union in a way that the board considers coercive. Without any proof that any voter actually saw this provision in the handbook, if you do anything unfair during the election campaign and it turns out that the union had a card majority, we're not going to look for those hallmark violations. We're going to simply order you to bargain. But, like Ron Popeil used to say, but wait, there's more. They're going to say that if the union, in advance of filing a petition with the National Labor Relations Board for a secret ballot election, offers to prove to you that it has a majority of cards, and you don't accept that proof and bargain based on it, and you do anything, any jot and tittle that's wrong, and you didn't ask for an election on your own, then we're going to make you bargain. Now, believe it or not, Congress had seen this act before. This is one of the things that Congress expressly addressed in the 1947 Taft-Hartley Amendments, because the board prior to 1947 had had the same rule. It was back then called the Joy-Silk Doctrine. And so what the current counsel of the National Labor Relations Board, and now a board majority as of this week, has done is to, I'm getting into Amazon.com services. I'm mixing CMEX and Amazon because they're all really one thing.
It's called the weave.
Okay. what they have said is we're going to make you bargain. And one of those little wrong things you do that can make you bargain is simply having a meeting of employees for your campaign purposes on paid time. That's why Section 8C is in the act, to outlaw the board holding the outlawed so-called captive audience meetings. We're now literally back to the labor law of 1946, and we're back there because of who's on the labor board and who's general counsel of the labor board. So what is, you know, I talk about oscillation and the physics of angular momentum. You know, it's going to be hard to put the toothpaste back in the tube. In fact, I would expect you're going to see, like the poor guy going down the zip line, you're going to see the oscillations get bigger. And let's talk about how those oscillations could get bigger. Well, one of the things that could happen is Congress could take up its own version of labor law reform. You've heard of the PRO Act, the Employee Free Choice Act. For the past 40 years, all of those labor law reform efforts have been coming from the left of the Democratic Party. Well, why shouldn't they come from the management side of the Republican Party? Maybe Congress wants to pass Taft-Hartley too. Maybe Congress wants to condition funding of labor agencies on compliance with the law as it is rather than as they imagine it to be. Congress could do those things, and who knows, might. what could the president do? Again, thinking in terms of larger and larger oscillations. Well, maybe the president doesn't just fire general counsel. Maybe the president fires administrative law judges, teeing up the issue of removal protection for administrative law judges. Maybe the president fires an EEOC commissioner or two, or a member of the National Labor Relations Board or two, teeing up reconsideration of Humphrey's executor. Maybe when there's a, whenever that is, when there's a new majority of Republicans at the National Labor Relations Board, maybe they seek to overwrite all these adjudication doctrines that have been created recently with a substantive rule, which would be a lot faster than doing it case by case in adjudication. Maybe, and here's my favorite one, I wrote an article in the Mississippi Law Journal on this in spring of 2023. It's called, is the NLRB required to follow Rule 56 in its summary judgment proceedings? Maybe the General Counsel of the National Labor Relations Board starts to take seriously the Taft-Hartley Amendment of Section 10B of the Act that says that the board in its unfair labor practice proceedings shall, so far as practicable, apply the federal rules of evidence and the federal rules of civil procedure. Those of you, who in here has actually litigated an unfair labor practice case? You actually represented a party in an unfair labor practice case. Okay, not many hands, so let me explain how it goes. It's like federal proceedings prior to the federal rules of civil procedure. If you're a respondent in a board case, you typically don't know who's going to testify against you or what they're going to say until they take the stand and testify, at which point you're allowed to ask them if they gave a pretrial statement, and they gave it to somebody like her, okay? And it will be uniformly favorable to the union, but sometimes their testimony doesn't come out the same way, so you've got a prior inconsistent statement, possibly. You're allowed to read that and then cross-examine them based on it and then give it back to them, and you don't get to keep it. And that's your discovery. And then, oh my, you find that you hadn't anticipated something you need to prepare for, and you ask for a recess so that you can prepare. You don't get it. It is trial by ambush. But all the board has actually ruled on this subject of following the federal rules of civil procedure is that they're not bound. It's the statutory language still leaves it in their discretion. Okay, what if the general counsel of the board says, okay, I'm using my discretion, I'm going to conduct our proceedings in compliance with the federal rules of civil procedure. So we're going to have Rule 26A initial disclosures. We're going to have interrogatories. We're going to have admission requests. We're going to have depositions. We're going to have document requests. We're going to follow Rule 56 in our summary judgment proceedings. We're going to have pretrial conferences, and we're all going to do that by a joint tender to the administrative law judge of a scheduling order at the start of the proceeding. That could usher in a revolution favorable to respondents in how the NLRB resolves unfair labor practice proceedings, and it could tee up a situation in which a Democrat majority at the board says to a Republican general counsel, you can't do this, and the Republican general counsel says, read the rule of Shankopotamus. Section 10B says, not only I can, but I shall. That could be just great fun in appellate litigation. What can judges do? What can courts do? We've talked about what the president could do, what Congress could do, what the general counsel could do. I myself like how Jarchese, y'all know about the Jarchese case? Okay, good. We all should know about Jarchese case. So Mr. Jarchese was allegedly, a rather clever securities fraudster. The SEC brought against him in its own in-house proceedings a claim that could have been brought in federal court, because SEC can proceed either in federal court or in its own in-house proceedings. And ultimately, the Supreme Court of the United States found could have been brought under the common law as it existed in 1791, and therefore, Mr. Jarchese was entitled to a jury trial of this claim. Now, Justice Gorsuch got into the Article III implications of this, not just Seventh Amendment. All the judges didn't go there. But the Fifth Circuit underlying opinion in the Jarchese case had gone there. So it's now back down to the Fifth Circuit. Now imagine how this could apply when it comes back up, and maybe we get to ALJ removal that's in the Fifth Circuit but not in the Supreme Court case. Maybe we get to the Article III issues that were not in the Supreme Court majority but might be in a new Supreme Court majority. Imagine how this could apply to NLRB unfair labor practice proceedings, because a hefty part of the docket, and a part that's especially influential on policing employers, is how the board resolves labor contract disputes under the guise of unfair labor practice determinations in its unfair labor practice proceedings. If you're a union and you think your employer has breached your employment contract, if you've got an arbitration proceeding in your contract, you go to arbitration. But typically a union will, because it, in an administration like this, the union thinks the NLRB is its most favorable forum, they will file an unfair labor practice charge and say that the employer, by breaching the contract, engaged in bad faith bargaining with the union, and unlawful under Section 85 of the Act. And sometimes the board defers that case to arbitration, but these days the board really doesn't like arbitration deferral that much, and it will resolve all those cases. Well, golly, folks, common law in 1791 recognized causes of action for contract breach. Why is a labor contract breach any more different than any other contract breach? We've got Section 301 of the Labor Management Relations Act, which creates federal district court jurisdiction of suits for contracts between labor and management. Why isn't the union using Section 301? Why does the board have jurisdiction of this at all? Isn't the employer in every one of those cases entitled to a jury trial on the issue of contract breach? Somebody's going to raise that, I predict. Especially somebody's going to raise it after the Fifth Circuit gets through reconsidering Jarchese, and if it goes back up and is not settled. I think that's coming. I've said a mouthful. Do I think that President Trump is likely to remove a board member? No, I don't. What would I do if I were President Trump? I would pick out an administrative law judge. And by the way, I'm familiar with an administrative law judge who once told counsel in a pre-hearing proceeding that you might want to consider settling because, as you probably know, but if you've looked at my record, I have never dismissed a complaint against a respondent. Let's find one of those guys, and let's remove him, and let's tee up the issues that flow from that. That's what I think you might see. I don't think you're going to see removal of a board member or an EEOC commissioner.
Great, thank you, Pepper. So I really enjoyed this story about the zip line. When you started, I thought the point was going to be that the zip line workers were organized and on strike, and it was going to be closed. But even better story. So why don't we maybe go back through the roster, starting with Brad, and maybe you have some reactions to what some of the other panelists have said, or any other comments you want to make.
Yeah, I think that when I hear Becky's story, I know that a lot of people who haven't served in government might be shocked and surprised. But as somebody who had served in government for a while, I wasn't surprised by that, and I find that to be very unfortunate. And I think that's something that those who serve in the upcoming administration need to keep in mind, is that it's tough serving in the deep state. And I see quite a few former alums from the Department of Labor, you know, here that I had served with there, and it's really important to keep in mind that, you know, when you talk about the deep state, I don't think you can really stress how deep the deep state is, and, you know, how every day it's a constant battle. And I think especially in the first Trump administration, where they saw it as, you know, this idea that we will obstruct anything that you try to accomplish. And I think that we've got a lot of benefits now, you know, going in with, you know, I think a mandate and so forth, but also, you know, with the Loper-Bright decision, you know, because whenever we were at Department of Labor, they would say, well, our statutory mission is this, our statutory mission is this, this justifies the direction we want to take, this, you know, we don't need to put anything out on this, it's the statutory mission. And now with that case, with Loper-Bright, it says, like, you don't get a thumb on the scale for the statutory mission. So I think that there's going to be a lot of aspects that really help us fight back against that. And I think that the public, you know, for DC, we live in a swamp. I live in Arlington right outside. And I think that it's really important to consider that, you know, that if you look at who's serving in the government, like 98% are on the other side. And they will come up with blocks and they will come up with ways to fight that. And I feel like, you know, I got very burned out from the government. I remember I was so excited one day, I typed this like long email to the EOC, like general counsel, and I was like, my wife was like, oh, well, why did you know, you seem so happy about that. I was like, yeah, it's gonna, like, you know, it's, and then my wife said to me, she's like, you know, but like, they're not gonna read it. You know, they're not gonna care. And she's like, you're so excited about something where, you know, it doesn't really matter. She's like, they're just going to ignore you. And that kind of dawned on me. That's when I kind of knew that I needed to go to private practice at that point. And I think that it's something to, you know, keep in mind, though, that the power of the deep state, it's very draining. And, you know, you've got to keep that in mind to fight the fight.
Becky, anything to add?
I do agree with Brad's comments. It's amazing how deep the deep state is. You don't want to see the sausage being made to work for government. Also, as Pepper talked about, you don't want to have to be the employer counsel. There are big, his zipline story is amazing, and I couldn't agree more. I'm sitting here and I'm just like, wow, that was my former life. Watching this play out, watching the swings back and forth, I do think the Supreme Court is starting to weigh in on it, McKinney versus the NLRB and the 10J injunctions, and the going back to the four-part test, where the board was just before allowed to find it just and proper, which is just a two-part, which is just basically the most of the time the court rubber stamping the board's request for immediate relief, and now they actually have to go by legal standards and go by a four-part test and actually prove a case, which has seemed beyond their comprehension when it came out. I was working there when that came out, and we had training, and it was interesting to listen to that side of the training. And then roughly a month after I left, we had training on it at my new management side consulting firm, and the training was completely different. It was really interesting to hear both sides and to hear the agency. I can't help but go back to the agency flaw, the agency exuberance versus real world, and versus some of the things that should be happening in the NLRB. But I could, and to Pepper's points about trying cases and that it's going backwards with the NLRB makes it go backwards.
A point about that. I ask you if you ever witnessed this. I know you did mostly representation cases, but something I witnessed defending respondents in unfair labor practice proceedings is that general counsel, by the way, general counsel is in Washington, D.C., but the NLRB general counsel operates through a number of regions, and we call them counsel for general counsel. They're in the regional offices, and they're the ones who actually try the unfair labor practice proceedings. And these are not usually in federal courtrooms. They're in like a government conference room somewhere. It's pretty informal. And the counsel, in my experience, the counsel for general counsel is so used to getting whatever they want from the administrative law judge. It's like they're a tag team against you. That's how it feels from the respondent's position. That they often show up underprepared, let's say. Compared with how they would be if they were in a real court before a real judge, because they sort of think that at least it appears to the respondent's side, they sort of think the ALJ has their back. And that makes for great fun if you're a respondent's attorney. My first boss in New Orleans was Sam Lang. Anybody here older than I am remember Sam Lang? Okay, Sam Lang had actually been one of the first regional officials of the National Labor Relations Board in New Orleans, and he considered himself a young socialist, and he switched sides. And he told me one of the first cases I had that the second greatest thrill is getting an innocent man off. By which he meant, you know, this kind of litigation where you're supposed to lose and where your client, probably guilty, is the most fun if you want to learn how to be a creative defense lawyer. And, you know, if NLRB litigation actually becomes due process, it'll be a lot less fun. It will. I'm in a small club of lawyers who, literally, we have this club. I bet Region 15 never knew about this, but we have a club of us who have actually made counsel for general counsel cry on the record. We'll be the last members of the club. They'll never be.
Well, this has been a colorful start, so a really great panel. Wish I could contribute, but. Why don't we, just a couple quick topics. Some of you have mentioned some priorities of the current administration or maybe the future administration. Anything that we can expect out of the EEOC or NLRB in the next 2 months? And anything that we should expect or you might hope to see out of those agencies in the coming couple of years?
I was gonna say, We have a lot to say. We probably have more than any other agency. We've had a couple of, I really think the GC and the board, who aren't supposed to work hand in hand along with the administrative law judges, but because there's always separation, but I really don't think there is any separation between any of them. They've been coming out fast and furious. I don't think they think they have the votes to renominate, to keep McFerrin and Deidelberg, to get the package deal through to ensure a Democratic majority, no matter even if there is a Republican general counsel appointed. So they're issuing decisions fast and furious. The past couple that have issued, one last Friday regarding employers, what employers can say during organizing drives and where you, how you cross the line by just saying the word promise or saying the word flexibility or just saying one simple word, go back to Pepper's points about like burying a rule deep in a handbook. Just that, just one little tiny thing can get you in trouble and get you a CEMEX bargaining order. Captive audience meetings this past week got a further ban on Wednesday. So they are taking all the liberties they can to issue all their pro-labor decisions in the next 4 weeks because I don't think that they think they're going to have enough votes. It is going to take a long time to undo it. Once we get an acting general counsel into place on January 20th at like 12:01 p.m., it will take forever for it to be undone. I'm not sure where it's going to go. Lopers and the rulemaking, and I'm not really sure what's going to happen. It's going to be, labor law is going to be quite in the state over the next few years.
Brett, are you involved in any of the cases challenging the structural constitutionality of the NLRB?
I'm not directly involved in those, okay. No.
Do we have anybody in the audience who is?
Okay. There's
so we have several people in the audience who are. I'm not like a kid waiting for Santa to come thinking that those are all going to succeed or any of them are going to succeed, but I'm having great fun watching those cases because of what they tell us about the adjustment of the relationship between the judicial branch and the fourth branch, the administrative state. And so if you're not watching those cases, I recommend them to your attention simply because regardless of how they come out on that particular issue, I think we're going to learn things about how the appellate courts and the Supreme Court are how far they are willing to go in changing the relationship between the administrative state and the judicial branch.
But I do want to flesh out what Becky had just said, because I think it's such a critical point. So she was referring to these captive audience bans. And essentially for the way that our system works is that, you know, that employers have a lot of freedom for what they can say, that, you know, unless that, you know, the freedom of speech, that it doesn't apply to the, you know, private workforce and unless a, you know, exemption applies. But the idea is that an employer is able to do what they want to do in the private workforce and that they could say what they want to say. And the NLRB has said that if you're going to have an employer meeting to, you know, educate employees on these are the benefits of, you know, not having a union and these are the risks, you know, these are the problems with it. And the NLRB is stepping in and saying no. And I think that there's some nuances there, but I think that I'm deeply concerned with the restriction on freedom of speech. And I think that, you know, that's a big concern. And you're seeing these laws, these captive audience bans. So essentially saying an employer cannot educate their workforce on the problems of unionization or, you know, the realities of unionization efforts. And you're seeing a big movement at the state level. So California, Governor Newsom just signed into law a captive audience ban in the state of California. But one of the concerns is that the way they define what that restriction applies to, it says it applies to political matters or religious matters. Well, what does that mean? How broad could that be construed? And you're seeing state captive audiences in Minnesota, Maine, there's been a bunch of other states as well. But I think that's something that we really need to focus on and say, is that a restriction? You know, there's challenges to the state captive audience bans, and it's, I think it's something to really pay attention to in the next few months and years.
Go ahead,
Pepper.
So those of you who practice representation part of NLRB law, do you get the joke about the captive audience ban, why it's damned if you're due and a damned if you don't situation. Some of you are nodding yes, but most of you are saying, huh? Okay, here's the joke. An employer is prohibited to poll its employees in order to determine their union sentiment or anti-union sentiment, or even to determine if they're undecided. That is a serious unfair labor practice. An employer is forbidden to visit employees at their homes during a campaign. An employer is prohibited from having any group meeting within the last 24 hours prior to the start of voting. So now if an employer can't call everybody to a meeting, all the eligible voters to a meeting, and it also can't poll employees by saying, okay, only those of you who want to hear our message show up, an employer literally has now no right to communicate with employees except maybe sending them text messages. Is that still legal? In other words, what they're doing is coercing employer speech, that is the absence of speech, in a way that is clearly violating, in my view, clearly contrary to the Taft-Hartley amendments, probably contrary to the First Amendment, and somewhat of an inside joke.
Just to build a tiny bit on Pepper's remarks about even text messages, there are, I can tell you that as of the past 2 weeks, there's one particular region who has gotten almost 800 unfair labor practices filed over text message campaign that I might or might not have seen. So those will start being investigated. And they were actual, just strictly informational text to say state the date of the vote, the time of the vote, what was coming out. Just if you would like more information, please visit a website. You could opt out, but they right. filed charges over just the actual employer sending a text message.
Okay, I'm going to wonder how much I can get for an hour of my time for the Vulcan mind meld, because that may be the only way left to communicate.
Good. So one of the themes of the conference and one of the themes of our panel is sort of the administrative law renaissance at the Supreme Court this past term and maybe even before that. Some of the cases have been mentioned, Jarkissi, Loper-Bright, Axon. McKinney was a NLRB-specific case, although I've heard it may have broader application to other agencies. But I'm just wondering, taking that sort of collection of cases, you've each touched on it a little bit, but are there issues you see going forward for the NLRB EEOC that will arise from the Supreme Court's decision and some of the recent cases?
Go ahead.
Well, I think that it's time's going to tell. I mean, I thought one of the things that I thought was very interesting is that in the dissent for Loper-Bright, you know, Justice Kagan wrote that AI regulations, you know, whether you can regulate AI, whether that is vulnerable under a Loper-Bright analysis. And I think it's going to be very interesting to see. And I feel like as far as, again, not getting that deference that, you know, the statutory mission and, you know, that reliance, I think that's going to be the most immediate impact.
I agree with you. I think time is going to tell. It's hard to really see what the impact is, although I think that, especially with the cases out there that all of you are involved with the NLRB's unconstitutionality and the way they're set up in the first place, I think that that's going to start playing into there. This McKinney versus Starbucks is going to start limiting the board's power to some tiny degree, maybe. I don't know. Well, that remains to be seen. But I think Pepper, it looks like he has a thought.
A large point and a small point. Let me start with a small point. If you're doing this kind of work, you should be aware of recent board cases that have said that if you want to raise these defenses, Seventh Amendment, Article 3, ALJ removal protection, and on and on and on, you must raise them in your first pleading in the proceeding or you have waived them. Even though some of them apparently contest jurisdiction, the board is saying they're waived if not raised in your first pleading in the unfair labor practice proceeding. So I'm now putting them in my position statement that I file with the NLRB. And then I've got a case where I filed an answer in April of 2022, and I just put the laundry list of all the structural unconstitutionality and everything in there. We still haven't had an ALJ hearing in that case. They have taken it back for reinvestigation. We're now on our going on 3 years of reinvestigation. Maybe you'll get reinvestigation too. And if you don't put those in your pleading, call your carrier. The larger picture, Humphrey's executor, these whole of government orders that the Biden administration started rolling out, whatever was the truth about the FTC in 1937 as to whether it was performing an executive role or performing quasi-legislative functions at the direction of the executive, which back then the Supreme Court said the FTC was not, and therefore President Roosevelt did not have the right to remove Mr. Humphreys. I don't see how you square that view with how the agencies, including the NLRB, the FTC, the EEOC, have behaved in response to the President Biden's whole of government orders on these issues.
I think one thing that, just to kind of bring this to a practical level, is that, you know, most of my day is spent advising employers on what the law is. So we'll get questions on how do we comply with the military leave law? How do we comply with these AI guidance documents that have come out? And I think that with the whiplash effect, the fact that it changes so rapidly from administration to administration, how do you comply with the law if it's constantly moving? And I think that with Loper Bright, I think that the idea of, you know, pushing for consistency. And, you know, we represent a lot of employers who operate, you know, throughout the country. And, you know, especially with the movement of state laws, how do you comply with this wide swath of laws? And I think that, you know, from an administrative angle, it should be geared toward having an idea. We want people to know what the law is. And, you know, you think about for employment law, one of the reasons I really like being a labor and employment lawyer is because jobs matter. I mean, it puts food on, you know, the table. It, you know, supports you, gives your life a purpose. And I think that for employment purposes, employers should be given the tools they need to comply with the law. They should know what it says. And I think that with the incoming administration, the guidance documents, the opinion letter request, and, you know, different ways to help them comply with the law. Because I think that, you know, oftentimes you hear, oh, the bad employer and all that. Most of the employers, I think all the employers that I've dealt with, you know, want to comply with the law. And it's just they need to know what the law says and not get this, you know, funny business with, well, we'll tell you later, this gotcha enforcement idea. So I'm really hopeful that for some of these administrative law, you know, decisions, that it really pushes us in the direction of more stability and more idea of transparency.
I couldn't agree more with you, Brad. I was just thinking about that. I mean, and coming out from government, it's a mentality within the NLRB that employers just want to violate the law. I got to tell you that coming out of it, employers actually want to comply with the law if only they knew what it was. I mean, otherwise, why would they hire people like Brad or myself or Pepper? If employers just wanted to violate law, they'd just go at it themselves. We, you know, it's much cheaper.
There is a perverse thing happening. I would say that even in the Obama administration, the prevailing, if not uniform attitude of employers was, we don't like the law, but dadgummit, we're going to do our best to comply with it. But as the administrative state makes it not only impossible to run your business and comply, but even to know what compliance looks like, you're getting more and more people just throwing up their hands and saying, I give up. and so there's a tipping point at which you actually get less compliance by demanding more compliance, and I think we're about to reach that tipping point.
I agree. If you don't know what the line is, how do you know when you've crossed it?
And I think since going into private practice from the government, I think that one of the things I have to continually tell myself when I'm dealing with clients is that clients don't believe how bad the government is. It's like when you tell them how the government's going to respond to their point, like oftentimes they'll say, well, we should just give, you know, we received from the EEOC a request for information or a subpoena, and, you know, we want to hand them all this information to show that we're, you know, we're doing everything, we're complying. I'm like, oh, no. No. And it's, I think that that's something that is really important to kind of keep in mind, is that it's, you have to kind of, in my time at the government taught me, it turned me into a total Ron Swanson. And that's why I really do appreciate the Department of Government Efficiency idea.
Yeah, about a decade ago, my football team, the Ole Miss Rebels, and the Mississippi State Bulldogs, our arch rival, were both investigated at the same time by the NCAA. And state lawyered up and gave them nothing and got a slap on the wrist. We cooperated. We fully cooperated. We turned over everything and then some, and we got the death penalty.
I agree.
Yeah.
And by the way, I support Pepper on his choice of football teams. but we did. It hurt. Don't cooperate with the government.
Well, I'm hearing a lot of gripes about the government, but I will say for the three of you, it's pretty good job security. So, you know, there's a silver lining to everything. So one of the great traditions of FedSoc programs is we had audience questions. So I have one more question, but then I'd love to hear from the audience. We talked a little bit when we were preparing for this about intra-agency MOUs, which maybe has been a development in the Biden administration. I don't know much about this, but I heard some of you saying this is something that's been occurring, and I don't know what the viability of those are going forward. Does anyone want to talk about that?
Yeah, so I think you have these things, they're called Memorandum of Understanding or Interagency or Intra-Agency Agreements, and essentially it's an agreement between different federal agencies to share information or refer a claim. So in theory, if you have an employment discrimination matter and you call up the Wage and Hour Division of the Department of Labor, which handles minimum wage issues over time, that the Wage and Hour Division would refer it to the correct agency, or they could share an investigation and say that, you know, that there's both wage and hour concerns, but there's also anti-discrimination concerns. But the Wage and Hour Division in particular has gone beyond just having federal agency, interagency agreements. They also have agreements with different state actors and so forth. So you have this wide web of, you know, the government. But the problem is that they'll say in defense of that, they'll say, well, this increases government efficiency. And I don't think it necessarily does. But, you know, why did Congress create separate agencies? You know, that it's supposed to stay in your lane. You don't want, you know, the idea of having this wide swath. But I think that recently, you've seen a big focus on this, especially to address artificial intelligence, these intra-agency agreements. And I don't know what the future of those are, but I think that it's just kind of just to generate noise, just for able to put out a press release saying, well, we've had an interagency agreement to address artificial intelligence. But what does that actually mean? But, you know, I think that one of the problems is that when you hear about a lot of these agreements, you don't see where the substance is. At least I didn't when I was at the EOC and Wage and Hour Division. But it's something I'm interested to see in the future for how those go about. I'm sure Becky has some thoughts on that too.
I agree. They don't have a whole lot of substance. And since I just left the board this past summer, I got to see all the Biden administration MOUs, which were great press releases and great photo ops. Means nothing. In fact, we tried to cooperate with a couple agencies tried to cooperate with us, and you'd have to write more letters, memos, briefs as to why they should share information back to you. It would take close to a year if you could get anything at all. It had no teeth. I don't know if you were there when any of the, memos were sent out or released. It's more about, I mean, we had them with the Mexican consulate. We'd go and smile and
I think they could have value. So, like, one of the issues is, you know, for board purposes at the NLRB, you have protected concerted activity. And what happens when that conflicts with anti-discrimination? So what if you're on a picket line or a strike and you're yelling comments that could be discriminatory? So, you know, they're taking our jobs or build the wall. You know, so one person could view that as protected concerted activity, but somebody else could see that as discriminatory or harassing activity. And there's a conflict between the EEO laws, the equal employment laws from the EEOC, and the NLRB laws. And how do you address that? And, you know, that's something where it might be useful to have some sort of guidance on that. Like, you know, where is the line? But unfortunately, the government hasn't, you know, provided something to try to walk that line. And I think that's particularly important because I do a lot of politics in the workplace concerns. So, you know, just generally speaking, you know, politics in the workplace isn't allowed, you know, employers are able to regulate it, except for certain states, but it's something where you're seeing a lot more interest in, because what if somebody's interested in a social justice issue, you know, commenting on the war in Gaza or so forth? So it gets into that, like, you know, what is protected concerted activity versus what's discriminatory? And that's something where it might be useful to have some sort of an agreement and guidance on that, but the government hasn't done that.
So if you two should be back in government at the EEOC and the NLRB, here's an MOU I'd actually like to see written and observed. There's an issue in the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, about what reasonable accommodation is. And it's very common in labor agreements to have spelled out in the event of a medical problem, here's what we will do. Here's what your rights are. Here's how long you can stay on the payroll. Here's what you have to do in order to retain your position on the payroll. You're literally spelling out what the employees, through their legal agent, believe to be adequate, reasonable accommodation, and what the employer says, okay, we will do that. And then the EEOC comes in and will sue that employer saying that's not adequate accommodation. Sue in the name of and on behalf of the employees, that's not adequate accommodation. And we say, wait a minute, read the labor laws. That union is the legal agent of the employee. They negotiate a deal with us just, it's just as legally effective as every one of those employees that hired a lawyer and negotiated the deal with us. And they will say, nah, that ought to be worked out by an MOU between the EEOC and the NLRB.
I agree. That's actually a really good idea. And it'd be nice to see if it ever comes to
but it. It has to be public, though. Like, I feel like a lot of the, you know, which the MOUs are, generally speaking, but I mean, as far as where is that going to go, as far as, you know, what's the backstory there? And I do think that even with MOUs, that there needs to be evidence that these are actually being effective, because I don't think there is any evidence that they're at all effective and they are increasing government efficiency.
Great. So do we have any audience questions? We have about 10 or 15 minutes for questions.
Robert Barker from Atlanta. Sorry if that becomes a comment more than a question, but it seems to me
that sounds to be typical at FedSoc events, but if it's possible to finish it with a question, that's always
appreciated. I've heard that. Yeah, I'll try to do that. But I know that some of the people in the audience have practice in other areas as opposed to the EEOC and the NLRB. Peggy Little has litigated most of these cases over here, and some of the cases, like, for example, the Axum case, I believe, it was the actual, some of the interim steps in that case led the SEC to actually withdraw some of its enforcement actions, just because it realized that it shouldn't be the judge and jury and prosecutor. And it seems to me that we can, I've heard Becky's story, and it's a terrible story, because we have these workmanlike people inside our government who are trying to do a good job, who find out that they can't do a good job unless they do it politically. And there's no incentive to act with humility in exercising this power. So I would like to see Humphrey's executor revisited by the Supreme Court. I would like some more thought given to that in this administration. It wouldn't bother me at all to see some of these NLRB members removed or FTC members removed. And I don't know where that will come from, or if the administration has the power to do that. They have the power to try it. Do they have the power to litigate it all the way to the Supreme Court? I don't know. And then the question is, what are the other areas that you see, I suppose, that are strategic, where we can make moves to work to resolve some of the inherent problems of the administrative state? FDR himself, I'm looking at a report from 1938, where FDR himself transmitted a report from 1937 talking about the fact that his administrative agencies threatened to become a fourth branch of government. Surprise. I mean, even FDR was surprised about, was concerned about this. Why can't we be concerned about it as lawyers?
Well, I'll give you the practical practicing lawyer viewpoint of that, is that clients don't want to pay to litigate those pointy-headed academic issues. The client's interest is in getting this over at the lowest cost, at the soonest possible moment, so they can get back to the focus of their business, which is why people like Peggy Little are critical to getting these things done, because a lot of people who are in business to be in business aren't interested in taking on those challenges.
Next question.
Follow the format of the previous questioner. With Rebecca's story, I was the solicitor for an agency called the FLRA, which is like the federal government version of the NLRB. We had exactly that same issue where a member of the FLRA, who's supposed to be a neutral, was communicating with the union's coordinating strategy with them in decisions where he was sitting. So to give you an idea of how endemic these issues are across all the government and how honestly how corrupt these agencies have become, unfortunately. My question to you is, if you could give two sentences to Elon and Vivek for DOGE, what would they, on the labor and employment agencies, what would those two sentences be?
go big.
Or go home. Go big, go deep, complete overhaul.
I wish I could remember Lane Kiffin's summary of his offensive strategy is, but it's, I think it's score from far. Score fast, score from far.
Well, I like this new format where we ask long questions and we put limits on the answers. two sentences, so that's a new new technique I haven't seen before. But it's very effective. Those are great answers. Okay, it's just the light's so bright, but whoever's up next, I can't see.
Hello, my name's Ray. I'm an employment litigator from Los Angeles. So along with federal law, we also have a lot of state laws to comply at with in California. And to address some of the discussion on the notice and just employers asking, how do I follow the law? In California, there have been a lot of instances in which the courts have made pronouncements of laws that have strayed quite far away from, I think, traditional understanding prior to court cases. So for instance, back in 2018, California Supreme Court adopted the ABC test to govern the determination of whether a worker is an employee or independent contractor, and that strayed from our prior Borrello test, which had been in operation for, I think, up to 34 years at that point. Are there any federal due process concerns you see with this type of whiplash on different types of ways to look at how we determine whether something is legal or not, where there are massive wage and hour consequences, for instance, in this example, that could potentially apply?
I think it's an excellent question. I mean, I do think that there is value in, you know, the idea of, you know, for voting with your feet, as far as, I mean, obviously people are leaving California and we see, you know, a lot of businesses that can't comply with these laws. Like when I was at Wage and Hour Division, I tried to keep myself, you know, when approaching issues, saying, if I were a new immigrant to this country and starting a family restaurant, would I be able to comply with the laws? And no, I don't think that, you know, I'd be able to. I mean, when you consider the host laws, especially in a state like California, and I think that, you know, especially for California, where you have so many vast array of laws, it's really hard to, you know, have compliance with that. So that's something, I mean, even for the artificial intelligence, most of the AI laws that are being proposed are at the state and local level. New York City has an AI law, Colorado recently signed one, and there's questions of, if you have this patchwork of AI laws, how can employers, you know, deal with that? And one of the concerns that we hear in a lot is, you know, dealing with federal legislation that has preemption to create a national standard on issues like that. So I think that's, you know, something, or even a moratorium of these laws. And, you know, with artificial intelligence, it's especially difficult because the technology is changing so rapidly. So how can a law, you know, that, how can it keep up with rapidly developing technology and the fact that legislators don't understand that technology? But it's an excellent question, you know, and it's a tough, I don't think there's an easy answer to that.
I agree, there's not.
Philip Hamburger made me a convert. I tend to think now that if there's a legal adjudication process that's not happening in an Article III court, it's not due process.
Okay. Thank you. Next question.
Devin Westhill. I work at a small nonprofit in Washington called the Center for Equal Opportunity. Fantastic panel, the entire panel, but I had a question about Brad's comment on artificial intelligence, and you suggested that artificial intelligence could be sorting out, for example, applicants on protected characteristics, and as a result, it might raise some disparate impact issues. That kind of struck me as sort of disparate treatment issue, but was your suggestion that you expect in terms of the development of policy around artificial intelligence at the EEOC or otherwise might benefit from exuberance of the disparate impact tool?
I mean, it's a tough question. So for kind of basic, you know, for those who aren't familiar with the, you know, for the basic idea for labor, for employment discrimination law, you have two different theories of discrimination. There's disparate impact, which is unintentional discrimination, and then disparate treatment, which is intentional discrimination. And with AI tools that are being used, if you take the data from a, you know, the ideal employee, and you say that we want to model, we want to select candidates who meet this particular criteria based on the data, and you import that, and it's based on an existing, you know, if there's bias involved. So if you say that the ideal employee is a white man who, you know, that came from a certain area, then you would build into that algorithm disparate impact so that it would favor selecting candidates who are of that degree. But what's really interesting, I think, with artificial intelligence is that, you know, so the, like, with that, backing up for a second, it's the garbage in, garbage out theory. So, like, you know, saying that AI selecting resumes can be more objective because you're taking out, you know, these different criteria, you're able to assess candidates without looking at their sex, without looking to their race, especially since a lot of names are often affiliated with certain national origin groups or certain races. And if you're able to take that away from the equation, it could make a more objective decision. But the problem is that if it has garbage in, garbage out, so it's inheriting those biases, one of the questions with AI that becomes very interesting is that when does disparate impact become disparate treatment? Because if those algorithms, if that AI is able to improve the discrimination, say that, you know, that based off of this, and it's a very interesting question, but what we're seeing from a practical standpoint with charges that are being filed with the EEOC dealing with AI is that they're alleging both. The plaintiff's lawyers are going for both disparate treatment and disparate impact. And so there, I think with AI, you're gonna see that line blurred more. And I don't think there's a firm answer about when does disparate impact become disparate treatment if an algorithm is doing the discrimination. So I think that's something that, you know, I think is a very fascinating area of labor and employment law to consider.
Okay, we have three.
I've got one thing to say in response to that. I know more than I should about AI for a guy my age because my son is head of a video game production studio, and what he tells me, what he shows me is just stunning. But our current model for assessing disparate impact, you know, multiple regression analysis of identified factors of selection, couldn't begin to address AI. AI is an iterative learning system that won't be the same 5 minutes from now as it was 5 minutes ago, and will be radically different than it was 5 months ago. I don't know how you would even begin to assess an AI system using our current disparate impact model.
Well, one of the things we're seeing is that if you're using AI tools to apply for a mass amount of jobs, so like let's say you're applying for, you know, if you're applying for over 10,000 jobs, 20,000 jobs, you know, one of the questions that I think is also very interesting is, will they have standing? And, you know, the EEOC historically has had a very generous view of standing, saying that even testers have standing, you know, that the idea that you're trying to test whether an employment decision, an employer is engaging in discriminatory practices, that they would have standing. But if you're using AI to generate mass applications and apply for hundreds of jobs or, you know, thousands of jobs, that's something that I think is an interesting question dealing with AI as well. And, you know, you have to revisit, should there be standing for candidates who have no intention of actually getting the job they're applying for?
Okay, we have three questioners in 5 minutes, so we could try to keep tight Hi. Questions, tight answers.
Hi all, this is a short question. My name is Tessa Scher, and we talked about breach of contract, but what other types of actions do you think are more appropriately decided by an Article III court?
Okay, so I'm going full hamburger here. It seems to me that in the ideal world run by Pepper Crutcher, if it's adjudication of private rights, and I don't like the phrase private rights either, if it's an adjudication of rights held by people who are subject to regulation by the government, that ought to be going on in Article III courts, or it shouldn't be going on. But let's work with what we've got right now. Let's assume that Atlas Roofing continues to be good law, Jones and Laughlin Steel continues to be good law. So you've got to say, all right, we're going to just pretend like Article 3 that says the judicial power isn't out there. We're only going to worry about the Seventh Amendment. What did the common law of 1791 say about this sort of claim we've got here? And I don't think we've looked nearly enough about the common law of 1791. Every time I see it come up in appellate opinion or Supreme Court opinion, they look at the common law of England. They go talk about Blackstone. There was a lot of American common law in 1791. You can go read Virginia reports from 1791, and I know I never see references. There's a lot of work for historians to be done about what common law claims were in 1791. I took 12 hours of Mike Landon's courses on the constitutional law of medieval and Renaissance England, for example. Believe it or not, there were several classes of workers back then who had property rights in their jobs. Was that still a law in 1791 for guild members or for certain low-level government officials? I don't know, but maybe every wrongful discharge suit was a common law claim in 1791. I think historians need to help us a lot more understand what was the jurisdiction of the common law courts in America and England in 1791 than we've understood so far.
Right, I think we have next year's topic for the panel. that'll be good. Great. All right, Tumar, go ahead.
I'll try to make it brief. One area where the traditional dynamics, liberal, conservative, employer versus employee expectations are flipped are on areas involving DEI and pronoun mandates and also vaccine mandates. And I advised some nurses who ended up striking over a vaccine mandate. I'm curious if from your perspective, you've seen any organization among labor around more conservative issues?
No.
No. No. I was going to say no. What we see are pay benefits, pay health insurance, and pension.
You know, when I negotiate labor contracts, I see a very clear dichotomy between the concerns of the institutional union leaders and the employees. The employees want two things: more money on my paycheck and more flexibility when I take time off. That's what they want. The union leaders think they're helping the employees by saying, no, you want these benefit plans, you want these job guarantees, and employees will go along with their leaders because they trust their leaders by and large. But I think you saw this in the recent election. The blue-collar employees' concerns and the concerns of their institutional leaders are not necessarily the same concerns.
Okay, you've been patiently waiting, so our last question.
This isn't even a question, but it also will not be a speech. Philip Hamburger established the organization for which I work, the New Civil Liberties Alliance, and on each of these points that you have been talking about, whether it be the jarcossy jury issues or removal protections for ALJs, due process, we're super interested in it, and we do our work pro bono, so just keep in touch.
Great, that's a great note to end on. So I have two very quick announcements. One, if you're staying for the Bork Lecture at 4:30, it's been moved to the International Ballroom, which I think is on this floor, and the reception that follows will be on the terrace level. And two, if you've not had a chance to look at the rare documents exhibit, which I think is worth doing, that's in the Cardozo room, and that is available today for the rest of the day. So with that, please thank me, or join me in thanking the panelists.
Great job.
Thank you.